This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Roz Taylor. On today's show, the US election is just 6 months away. Why is Donald Trump still leading in key states, despite everything? The House of Podmasters is launching a brand new podcast counting down to the vote. It's called American Friction. It's out this Friday, and regular Nikki McCann-Ramirez of Rolling Stone magazine will be joining us to talk about the campaign. Plus, we'll be chatting local elections. Will a wave of Labour mayors want more power, and would Starmer give it to them? And in the extra bit for supporters, what's the right level of ruthlessness in a politician? Let's meet the panel. First up, social affairs specialist and Oh God, What Now regular, Hannah Fearn. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Ros.
Nearly 9,000 women in their 30s left the teaching profession last year. I can well imagine why, and the spate of murder attempts on teachers isn't going to help. But what can we do about it?
I think it's really interesting because it is actually the largest demographic leaving the profession. So teachers across the board are thoroughly pissed off and don't enjoy their job at the moment. But it's women in their 30s who are kind of in their early mid-career, who are getting into leadership positions, who are leaving en masse. And it's a massive problem for the stability of schools. I mean, as you say, what are the reasons? It's because of childcare. I mean, you can't be surprised that a profession that is keen on children and young people might attract people who want to have a family. And yet we can't seem to manage our schools in a way that leaves people able to juggle senior leadership with motherhood and that responsibility on often a salary that can't then afford to outsource it via paid help, basically. What can we do about it? I mean, my immediate reaction is it's got to be about pay, because it's not just that people are leaving for more attractive salaries because they want a better lifestyle. It's that they can't actually live a functional lifestyle on the hours they're expected to do on the salaries they're on. But the New Britain Project, which is a new think tank doing some quite interesting stuff, is actually carrying out some research now. And it's asking those women who have left during that period a bunch of questions about what they really needed and what they would want to return. So I'm looking forward to that coming out because I think it might provide a blueprint for Labour.
Next up is Guardian columnist and author of Politics, A Survivor's Guide, Raphael Baer. Hi, Raph.
Hi, Roz.
Your Guardian column this week will have annoyed some Scottish nationalists. You say there are a few similarities between Hamza Yousaf and Rishi Sunak. Tell us why.
First of all, there's sort of an obvious non-political similarity, which is that they are both party leaders and heads of government of South Asian origin, which are first in the UK, in Europe. And that in itself is, I think, worth remarking on, because actually it says a very positive story about UK-wide success in integration of immigrant families going back a couple of generations, which is enormously successful by European standards, certainly. But that's not what I wrote about. But I think it is worth flagging because it is a similarity that stands out. What I actually wrote was that they are both, they have a common misfortune in having sort of taken on the chalice of leadership of their parties just at the moment when the amassed volume of poison in that chalice from a very, very long incumbency had become really toxic. And so they ended up sort of being chosen. Really, I mean, classically, to mix the metaphor, it was the kind of hospital pass. It was right at the end of a period when there had been a great ideological dominance. And the argument I made, well, sort of two of the arguments I made, one is that actually when a party is dominant for that long, you essentially have sort of one party rule, a certain type of politician can climb up the apparatus. It sort of promotes people who are very good at working internal hierarchies, often, you know, either, you know, fanatical zealots, the sort of Liz Truss type, or the kind of uninspiring apparatchik type figure who might be superficially charming and pleasant, but actually hasn't really been tested properly in political battle, isn't necessarily good at running a government. And I think Rishi Sunak and Hamza Yousaf are very similar in that respect. They seemed like safe choices to the sort of the internal bubble of their parties. But actually, you know, when you put them out front and made them run a government, turns out they didn't necessarily have the skills. And the second point, I think, that follows from that is ideologically, the rigid, sclerotic dogma that had dominated these long incumbencies imposed the kind of narrowness of failure of imagination. And what that has in common, you know, what I argue is nationalism in the case of the Conservative Party, Brexity nationalism, the tendency just to blame everything that has gone wrong previous to Brexit on Brussels and the EU, and then afterwards to say, well, the problem is we just haven't done Brexit properly. And actually a very similar dynamic operates with Scottish nationalism in terms of just wanting to blame everything on Westminster. And if your domestic policy doesn't work, well, it's just because Westminster's not letting you have the freedoms you would like. And so because the SNP is a pro-European party, and because an independent Scotland would have as its ambition rejoining the European Union, and for all sorts of other reasons, comparing the independence project to Brexit is something that goes down very, very badly in Scottish nationalist circles, in my experience. But that doesn't mean it's not a valid analogy.
Yeah, I think we will get complaints. And as I mentioned, our guest this week is Nikki McCann Ramirez, a politics reporter based in Washington, D.C. for Rolling Stone magazine. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to A God What Now. You're a regular panelist on the brand new Podmasters podcast, American Friction, out every Friday until November's US election. The first edition is out today, and there's a link in the show notes so you can listen. Nikki will be joining our own Jacob Jarvis and Oh God What Now producer and bunker host Chris Jones to unpack the weird reality of American politics. She'll be talking to leading US commentators and journalists about the issues that will swing the election. Nikki, what should we expect in the first episode of American Friction?
Oh my goodness, there's so much to unpack. As you said, American politics is constantly bizarre, incredibly fast-paced, and ever-changing. Some little teasers I can give is we will talk about South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem shooting a puppy and bragging about it. It's a bad one. We will, of course, give updates on Trump's trial in New York City. And we'll give a little bit of a read through with our first guest, Molly Jong Fast, about what to expect in the coming election cycle.
It's a must listen. As we mentioned, the election is only 6 months away. Donald Trump would like to be out on the campaign trail. Instead, he's sitting fuming in a New York courthouse accused of paying hush money to a porn star. But it seems to have had no impact whatsoever on his popularity. In key states like Georgia and Arizona, Trump is still ahead of Joe Biden. And that's despite a strong US economy. What would it actually take to shake his supporters' loyalty to Trump? Nikki, Time magazine has a big, scary interview with Trump this week. It was a pretty disturbing preview of what he wants his second term to look like, to say the least. What did we learn from it?
Well, I think much of it we kind of already knew, but not so condensed as to all be in one interview. And it's kind of one of those things where you hear his rhetoric on immigration, on abortion, on January 6th. You get little snippets of it throughout his campaign speeches, his public statements, his Truth Social posts. But it's really jarring to see it all in one article through one interview. My colleagues at Rolling Stone have actually been tracking a lot of these statements that he's made in a big list that we keep updating every couple weeks or so. I think obviously one of the things that got the most attention was his promise to pardon all of the January 6th rioters. As I'm sure you know, he is currently facing two criminal indictments related to his actions on January 6th and in the aftermath of the 2020 election. And like you said, a lot of these statements have been public knowledge. A lot of these positions have been public knowledge. And it doesn't really seem to sway the needle with his base. We see through polling that the people who love Trump and are not going to stop loving him. The people who dislike him and are not going to stop disliking him. Where he and Biden are both the most vulnerable is among independent voters in the United States. Voters who are sort of unhappy with both options or are quote unquote low information voters who don't really pay attention to the nitty gritty of election cycles and the day-to-day horse race of American politics. And quite frankly, I think the biggest threat at this point to Trump's candidacy isn't necessarily the criminal trials themselves and the possibility of a conviction, but the reality that the longer Trump spends sitting in a courtroom where he is mandated to be because he is a defendant, the less time he can actually spend campaigning, the more money he has to throw at these criminal cases that he can't spend on advertising, on campaign events, on sort of grassroots get out the vote movements. And he complains about that regularly. He says it in court all the time. He'd rather be campaigning. And we've seen that Joe Biden is pulling in way higher fundraising numbers than Trump, especially in the first quarter of 2024. So anything that is creating a dent in that monetary gap between the two candidates, because money in American elections is make or break, that could ultimately be one of the things that causes that sort of gap between Trump and Biden to widen, especially if he's unable to bring more independents onto his side.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because on the face of it, the fact he's stuck in a courthouse for a lot of the time would seem to be hampering him. But on the other hand, he has a massive social media operation with Truth Social and so on. And he has endless news coverage of the trial on American TV. Is that enough to keep his supporters engaged, or are they getting bored because he can't really say anything on the screen?
Well, it's not necessarily that he can't say anything because he has been saying it. I think one of the biggest pieces of news from the trial that we got this week was that the judge found him in contempt of a court order barring him from publicly commenting on witnesses, jurors, court staff, prosecutors in the case, and fined him $9,000. But like you're saying, I think for Trump, he almost sees it as a benefit to himself to goad the judge into punishing him, because then he can come out and play the victim, re-up this narrative that he is being unfairly prosecuted, that this is election interference, that these are just, you know, political persecutions. And so the judge is trying to strike a very delicate balance here between treating Trump as he would any other defendant, because the reality is that he may be the former president, but right now he is a private citizen. He is not an office holder. And I think the most he is entitled to in terms of special treatment is, you know, Secret Service security at the courthouse to make sure that nothing happens to him. So the judge has to strike a balance between treating him like a defendant and making sure that Trump isn't allowed to use in-court decisions to sway public opinion in the case. Well, he can do that, but more importantly, sway the jury's view of the case. The jury is supposed to be sequestered. They're not supposed to be consuming news. But as you said, Trump is ubiquitous. And if he can't find a way, or if he's physically barred from commenting on the case, he will still use every platform he has to malign this prosecution as political. And his supporters eat it up. They've been eating it up for the last like 8 years.
Judging by the Time interview, he seems to want to be more ruthless next time, if there is a next time. Avoid having people around him who might push back as they tended to do in his first term. Is his strategy to put a bunch of extremists in place and let them have their heads? Do you think the Time interview gave a good impression of what he's actually planning to do, or will he still have trouble pushing through that agenda?
I don't think he'd have much trouble. I think Trump, as we learned in his first term, values loyalty above everything, and he sees any sort of questioning of his position, of his goals, as a lack of loyalty. We've seen it in all the public officials who left his administration and then went on to criticize the former president, even in the mildest of terms. They are now his enemies. And one of the things that, in my view, is the scariest promise he's made, because he's made plenty of scary promises, is this vow he's made to sort of gut the bureaucracy, gut federal agencies, and replace the people he fires with Trump loyalists, with people loyal to his agenda who are willing to execute without really questioning. Because in his first term, one of the things that he found was he would try to do things and federal agencies and courts would block him. And we saw in Trump's term how hard Republicans worked to not only appoint three Supreme Court justices, but fill the lower judiciaries with Republican conservative activist judges. And now, I think the best example is in the slew of abortion legislation we're seeing in states in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade. so many of these previously unthinkable abortion bans are now getting passed into law under the guise of conservative judges appointed under the Trump administration. When Trump comes into office, he learned from his past term. They've talked about it in their election strategy going into 2024. They are planning to once again level sort of quote unquote election fraud challenges in states where they win or where they lose or don't win by a big enough margin. And we can see that they have taken everything that happened in the first Trump administration and are sort of creating a playbook, not just around Trump, but around the people who are expected to be his advisors, his cabinet, on how to more effectively implement the desired policies they want without necessarily running into issues with the bureaucracy, with Congress, with the judiciary. So yeah, I think the Time article did a fantastic job in distilling just how aggressive and just how, like you said, ruthless a second Trump term would be. They're not coming into this under the idea that they're going to be overseeing a democracy where people vote and have the ability to weigh in on what they want their government officials to do. They're seeing this as revenge for the last 4 years.
Oscar, it's fascinating. I'm just brilliantly articulated and mesmerizingly depressing. I have a question, actually, though. Okay, this may sound a bit like it's coming out of nowhere, but RFK suddenly appeared, RFK Jr., I should say, suddenly appeared on my radar. Is he a big thing? Is that a significant? Should I be worried about this in some way?
RFK Jr. is a really interesting figure because he is, in a way, a bit of a Frankenstein's monster. And the reason is he originally ran as a Democrat as a challenge to Biden. And he was very heavily propped up by Trump's allies, by right-wing media outlets like Fox News, as sort of a spoiler candidate for Biden. The problem became that Republican voters aligned much more closely with RFK's policies and politics than Democratic voters. Obviously, I think some of the stuff that's been getting the biggest amount of news coverage is his history of endorsing conspiracies, particularly vaccine conspiracies. The organization he runs was very instrumental in pushing and popularizing the myth that vaccines cause autism. And I think now both campaigns are stuck in this weird position. Trump and Biden's campaigns are stuck in this weird position where they're each trying to offload the quote unquote RFK constituency onto the other candidate. Because the reality is that this election is so close that only a handful of percentage points to a third party candidate can be incredibly decisive.
Nikki, what have Democrats consistently not understood about Trump and his appeal? Hannah, you've been looking at this, haven't you?
One thing I think is really interesting is it's a really old survey, actually. It was from before Trump was last time elected, but I think some of the stats still stand, which is that about how people feel about themselves. So only 10% of Americans say that they consider themselves lower class, and only 1% thought they were upper class. So like the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of Americans say they're middle class, but not everybody can be, you know, economically middle class in that way. And so there are obviously a lot of Americans who considered themselves to be in a position where they would be much better off under Trump, who actually weren't last time around. And how far is that kind of sense of identity going to play a role this time?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest mistakes the Democratic Party has made in the last 10 years is really working overtime to tamp down the influence of the left's progressive populist wing. They have, in my view, really caved to the attacks against progressive Democrats as being socialist, as being like out of touch with the majority of the country. I think that one of the reasons Trump is so popular, as you said, is because there are all these economic disparities in the United States, and you had this man approaching them from a stance of right-wing populist who promised to lift them up from the struggles Americans have been facing since the 2009 financial crisis, which we've recovered from, but theoretically recovered from, but has still resulted in a widespread stratification of American economic life. Democrats, we saw it particularly when former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi decided to retire. They, you know, sort of ushered in Hakeem Jeffries, who was sort of the heir presumptive to a very similar style of politics as Pelosi, While at the same time, not to say that any member of the squad was necessarily ready to be Speaker of the House, but you had this very strong coalition of progressive Democrats. You had the people falling sort of in line with Bernie Sanders in 2016, who were sidelined in the Democratic Party and sidelined on leftist politics and told that you are too radical, your economic proposals are like unviable and don't, you know, resonate with the average American, when in reality, a lot of the policies being proposed by the progressive wing do. And I think one of the reasons so many voters, especially independent voters, are disillusioned with the Democratic Party is because they keep saying, oh, we're the party of democracy, we're the party of better governance, we're the party that will do the things you want to see done and not delivering. And you can take that argument into how, you know, the end of Roe v. Wade and the crisis of reproductive health care in the United States could have been avoided had Democrats acted a little more ruthlessly, as you were saying, even a decade ago, to ensure that we had the proper people in the judiciary, to ensure that we were codifying these things into law, but refused to because they didn't want to anger certain factions of the Republican Party or more conservative-leaning independents. So if we're talking about ruthlessness, I think one of the things that the Democratic Party has failed in is not embracing a little bit the really active wing of their party that is trying to bring people into the fold, that is trying to raise enthusiasm about elections through popular policy that helps individual voters.
One of the things I find fascinating about this is that relative to Europe, which is the other sort of global locus of democracy, liberal democracies that might be advertising a system that we would ideally like to keep for humanity for a while at least, the American economy has performed pretty well. That should be a good story that Biden can tell. And I get the impression, and I have seen polling on this, but I can't recall exactly where, that it's a function of the sort of hyper-partisan character of American politics now, that Republicans in particular, or Trump voters in particular, are so committed to the idea that Biden is and Democrats are bad for America, that they will actually, that will sort of override any perception they might otherwise have had, that actually the economy has served them well. Now, it might not have served them that well. They might, you know, because of inflation, there are other factors that mean they're not feeling the economic strength that perhaps on paper exists. But even so, the idea, the possibility that you basically, it's not the economy stupid anymore, because people will literally turn away from the evidence of what the economy actually is if it's sort of, it rubs against the sort of cognitive dissonance of the candidate they'd rather support.
Oh, absolutely. And I think I might be wrong on this, but I don't think the economy is in the top three issues anymore for voters going into this election. Republicans have been really drilling in on the economy, but primarily they've been drilling in on culture issues, immigration, education, issues of gender and sexuality. They call them the culture wars, and it's correct. It's political culture warring. And I think one of the very interesting things that I've observed in my reporting at Rolling Stone is the sort of reality that Republicans have the majority in the House of Representatives in Congress right now, and Biden has tried to come to the table multiple times to negotiate, particularly on the issue of immigration and on foreign aid. And we've had the Republican-controlled House of Representatives reject a massive bipartisan immigration reform bill, which would have completely reshaped the landscape of American immigration in a way that a lot of Democratic voters, particularly progressive Democratic voters, would not have been pleased with. The reason Republicans rejected it was not necessarily because they had any issues with the law itself, but because they did not want to hand Biden a policy win in an election year. So what you're saying is entirely correct, that this election isn't necessarily being decided by voters sitting down and reviewing all of the evidence of their lawmakers' voting records and how the economy has been trending in the last year. It's being influenced by the absorption of what is being said by your social circles, by the news you're consuming online, by the statements you're hearing on the news you watch on television. And it is sort of Groundhog Day in the sense that it's a bit of a repeat of what we saw in 2020. Like, we're 6 months out and it once again feels like we're having the arguments about like trying to convince disillusioned voters who feel that neither of these candidates have done enough for them in Trump's 4 years or Biden's 4 years to feel strongly about which way to vote. We're now once again seeing the, you know, like vote blue no matter who, like it's the death of democracy if you don't vote. And a lot of people feel that they haven't been presented the convincing argument as to why they need to vote, despite having the evidence available in front of them, like you said.
I think one of the things that's terrifying from the outside on this actually is that even if Trump doesn't win, the impression of the American Republic being now sort of bifurcated into two separate nations with their own information sources and their own social, cultural norms and spheres, that's a schism so profound it's not even one nation anymore. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but that to me looks really quite structurally damaging for the existence of the America as we've known it since, you know, for the 20th century, basically.
Oh, I agree completely. Like, as someone who has deeply covered misinformation and, you know, right-wing media ecosystems throughout my work, both at Rolling Stone and my previous job, you are seeing a world in which people are living in just different realities. Like, the way there's no sort of consensus in the United States about, like, what the political and social reality is. And it is leading to more violence. It is leading to more political sort of, like you said, it's a political schism. And as Marjorie Taylor Greene, the like right, far right congresswoman from Georgia, once said, she's calling for a national divorce. That, you know, the United States is simply so ideologically split that we should be a republic in name and nothing else.
Because secession worked out so well last time.
Yeah, I know. But it's a horrific notion that a sitting member of the US Congress is making statements like that. Like,
yeah, particularly terrifying for anyone who's seen the Civil War movie. Thanks so much for joining us, Nikki. That's fantastic. Looking forward very much to the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now let's have a question from one of our Patreon backers in But Your Emails. If you support us on Patreon, you too can submit a question for the panel. Make it a good one. This week's comes from Pete Keyes, who writes, Andrew Marr says senior Labour figures want to retain the Rwanda bill. If Labour win their expected majority, wouldn't ripping it up on day one be a big clear statement that things have changed, akin to New Labour making the Bank of England independent? Hannah, what do you think? There's sort of been some artificial pushback on this, but it's introduced an element of doubt that Labour wouldn't scrap Rwanda, which is frankly pretty horrifying, isn't it?
It is. There's kind of a bit more to that question than was submitted. So would they hold it until a send-back deal is agreed with Europe? Because I think that's the key thing. It's not we're saying we're going to retain this forever. The anxiety among those senior Labour figures that Mar quotes is around what are we going to do if there's a vacuum in policy? And one of the quotes from Andrew Marr's piece is that a senior figure said to him, we can't just tear it up and have nothing in place. My response to that is, yes, we can, because that's what we've had for months and months and months. In all of this time that we've been waiting for the bill to become an act, we haven't had anything in place. So, of course, you can rip it up. And, yeah, it introduces that element of doubt that's incredibly useful to Sunak and his team. This idea that it doesn't make a difference who you vote for because they're all the same anyway. That is a hangover from the Corbyn era, that there's an element, a hard rump of traditional Labour voters who now think that, you know, that there's no difference between Sunak and Starmer, which is such an insane view. I can't really engage with it in a meaningful way. But this kind of speculation, it does feed into that. And that's why it worries me. I don't think it's a reality that it's going to stay in place. I think it will be scrapped pretty quickly. But I worry about what this kind of reporting on it does in the pre-election period.
Raf, is this just Labour being overly cautious again, or do we need to worry?
It can be both. I mean, I agree with Hannah that the part of the problem is the sort of cumulative effect just on top of everything else. It feels like there's nothing that the top leadership of the Labour Party won't potentially cave on if they think at some level it's going to animate concern in a very specific electoral segment where people are wary of, you know, of some phantom idea of Labour that they can't support. Particularly around issues of immigration, and you know, this connects to things we've discussed many times before about Labour's queasy, incoherent position on Brexit. I'm a little bit more inclined to understanding the point about if you have just taken over as a government and there is a law, or more than one law actually, on the statute book and a system that's operating. It's not quite straightforward to just say, well, we're just not doing that anymore. You know, there's a difference between a bill and an act. I mean, it's very hard to know what the sources are for this, and no one seems to be standing it up. And the comment is, we might be forced to keep it for a bit, you know. So there's a lot is being poured into the gaps of not very clear statements. So it's feasible that if actually, yeah, there is a system up and running, it's not entirely straightforward from a governance point of view to just throw it all on the bonfire on day one. However, where I'd agree is it is quite straightforward to stand up and say, we have no intention of keeping this year. We still think this is a wrong and a bad system and we are going to replace it. But just because we are responsible ministers and responsible government, you know, we have to do this properly and by the book. So bear with us while we fix it. That seems to me a reasonable position to have. And I don't quite understand why they haven't articulated that more forcefully just to shut down all the speculation about this.
They're finally here. If you're listening to this on the way to the polling station, have you got your voter ID? If not, turn around now and get it. You don't want to get into a row with the election staff, even if you're in the right, and we know you are. Raf, everyone's been talking about the mayoral races in Birmingham and Tees Valley. The consensus seems to be that Sunak might be under threat or even call that general election if Street and Houchin lose. But the fairly distinguished political science Philip Cowley said today he wasn't that interested in Birmingham Tees Valley because they won't tell us a lot about underlying Labour support in a general election. In other words, they're all about big personalities. Which mayoral races are you watching most closely?
Well, first of all, I'd say Philip Cowley is more than fairly distinguished. I think we're doing a bit of a disservice there.
Yeah, no, he is. Sorry, Philip, if you're listening to this.
Yeah. I'd say that, yeah, reasonably.
He's not quite.
He's possibly very distinguished.
He's not quite John Curtis, though, is he?
Yeah. Have you just called Philip Cowley like pound shop John Curtis?
No, I have not, Raf.
Good. That would be a very unfortunate thing to say. Anyway, sorry. The question. It is true that the big personality names sort of change the calculus a little bit, although that in itself means does teach you something. So I do think I agree the Ben Houchin one less interesting. Andy Street I think is nonetheless interesting because it will tell us if he holds on. First of all, the Tories will be jubilant and totally fail to understand why it's happened, but because he has run so clearly as really nothing to do with those awful Tories, no, not them, never heard of them, Rishi Sunak, who's he? It is in a sense where the swing is and by what margin he holds on, or if he can't hold on, it's still telling you something about whether a slightly more moderate, reasonable, centrist Tory proposition has purchased, because that's the one thing Rishi Sunak and the current iteration of the National Tory Party have totally failed to even try in any meaningful way. So that's interesting. I think also the East Midlands one is quite interesting. It looks like Labour will win that, as the polling suggests that, but because it's new and because there are a lot of marginal seats in the Midlands, that'll tell us something about the sort of the mood in that part of the country. And the New York and North Yorkshire one is fascinating and colourful in a way, just because it's got Rishi Sunak's Richmond constituency in it. That's posh rural Yorkshire. That's Tory country, and yet, I mean, there's lots of different bits of that new combined mayoral authority area, but yeah, certainly to judge by polling and local polling is very, very difficult, but it's kind of neck and neck. So that is even close is also telling us something quite interesting about, you know, how right the national polling might be and what kind of wild results we could look out for on a general election night in seats that, you know, have never been Labour before, that sort of thing. So that's sort of, I'm more interested in those.
You described these devolved structures as a hot mess earlier this week. Why?
Because they are. No, I mean, we're talking only about England here, really, and although the same sort of applies across the UK, but these are English elections. The structures of devolution and local government have been assembled piecemeal over a long period, and then actually just with an acceleration really since 2009, 2010 with towards the end of the Labour government and then the coalition government, Localism Act, local mayoralties, elected mayoralties, combined local authorities. And then, I mean, just as a simple example, there was a point at which there were three mayors of Liverpool. One of them was the Lord Mayor. That's a ceremonial role. Lots of cities have that. So, but there were definitely two mayors of Liverpool, because there was a city one, an elected local authority leader, because some local councils, you know, chose to have elected leaders. And then you had a combined Liverpool City Metropolitan Authority. So one of the new ones that's being created, that's being contested this time round, is the North East Mayoral Combined Authority. But that's not the same as the North East Combined Authority, because the North East Mayoral Combined Authority subsumes the North East Combined Authority and also the North of Tyne Combined Authority. Although the current mayor of the North of Tyne Combined Authority is running in the North East Mayoral Combined Authority, you know, formerly, he was a Labour mayor. He's running as an independent. I mean, it is a hot mess, basically. And it's incredibly confusing. And the lines of, and who has exactly what powers is slightly different. You know, the powers that Sadiq Khan has in London are not the same ones that Andy Burnham has in as Metro Mayor of Manchester, or necessarily the ones that Andy Street. It's kind of bizarre.
That's the most confusing thing about it all, is that through the Localism Act, there were all these agreements which were sort of bespoke arrangements, how the mayorship's going to work and what powers they'll have in each of these city deals, which were negotiated, which I understand that the point of that was supposed to kind of bring out this kind of dynamism and exciting, bring back some real excitement to local politics. But actually, just nobody understands what any of it does. And even I don't understand some of it. And at that time, I was covering local government for The Guardian. And it's just like 10 years later, I've let some of it slip from my mind because it's so
It's incredibly
boggling.
Hard to keep in your head. It's one of those things I have known about many times, and each time I come back to it,
you have to teach yourself every time.
Localism, everyone, you know, agrees is a good thing, devolved authority. But in truth, central government has taken more and more power away from local authorities. How hard would it be to give it back, Raf?
Very hard, for the simple reason. Well, no, actually not that simple. But the first simple reason is because the Treasury doesn't like it. And the Treasury is an immensely powerful institution, as you know. There is this strange phenomenon about, I mean, let's start with a crucial proposition about the British state generally. It's very odd. It's enormously centralised, the most centralised of any democracy, you know, really, but one of the most centralised democracies in the world. But the centre is actually really also quite weak and underpowered in some respects. So number 10, Downing Street, it's a messy, terrible institution. It's not clear. The Cabinet Office, what even is that? It's sort of evolved over time. Prime ministers very quickly feel, it's the old phrase, rubber levers. You know, you pull something and nothing actually happens. You don't know how you get anything done. So very quickly in power, prime ministers start to get paranoid and greedy about how much power they've got. And they see the Treasury kind of across the road, which has big, powerful, strong levers and also chances like to hoard power. So with those two factors, persuading the centre to actually give money, especially tax-raising powers, because money is really what really talks in terms of having control over policy delivery, persuading that centre to give away those sorts of powers is incredibly hard. It's the sort of thing that only happens at the very beginning of an administration, before that paranoia and fear and frustration kicks in. So, for example, if Labour are going to do any more devolution, if they don't do it in the first 6 months, I promise you they won't do it.
Anna, there's a decent argument that says local elections really shouldn't be a reflection of national issues. Mm. If you like the way your local councillor does their job, how important is their politics? Because there will be a lot of people listening to this, possibly on Thursday, thinking, well, how much should my, shall we say, dislike of the Conservative Party feed into my vote?
I feel really torn on this because in some ways I think it should be important because the idea is that you're not just electing somebody to manage your local area. You should also be electing someone who has an idea about how your local area should be run, the kind of overarching politics of that. But it is, as you say, always confused by people's relationship with the centre and the current government. And so, yeah, that, if there's, a new hospital being built in your area and you're broadly supportive of that and there's a councillor that is really strongly behind that, you might be moved to vote for them, whatever their national politics. But the problem is that doesn't work both ways. When there's like a big national crisis, councillors can't win because they might be doing a brilliant thing locally. Your local area might be working better than ever, but if your party is embroiled in a national crisis, you're going to feel the pain. And because they aren't given that freedom, because the funding doesn't channel through into local government and the services that they do control, it's very hard for them to actually demonstrate that they are competent anyway. Equally, it's very hard for people to actually understand when their local council is incompetent because it's impossible to unpick sometimes from the national picture.
And there's so little local reporting anymore to show you what's going on.
Absolutely, really important point, actually. We've got virtually no good quality local government reporting in this country anymore. And what little there is basically directly funded by the BBC. Even for outlets that aren't the BBC, they support as a competition to keep their own quality of reporting up. But even that's not really working.
Do people overestimate how much councillors can do? Or do they underestimate how much councillors can do? Do they have much idea at all, do you think, generally?
I think they overestimate their power because it's an elected role. You feel like you ought to be able to exercise, significant control in the decisions that are made in your area and actually make things happen when often they're really hamstrung by the relationship with other agencies and with the funding coming from the centre. They also, I think, underestimate how much they actually do get done on a micro practical level and how they just keep the small cogs of a local area turning, the bits that no one thinks about, the bits that aren't potholes or social care, but kind of the cogs of the local economy. Nobody understands that and they underestimate that. So again, I think being a councillor is a really tough job and I really admire anyone who wants to put themselves up for that role because it's misunderstood to the point of being maligned, I think.
Should they have more powers over housing or do they have too much already? Because delivering this big house building programme that Labour wants is going to be hard enough already without dealing with local planning committees.
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? I think in theory, on paper, they should have more. They should have all the control. But in the reality of the world we currently live in with a massive housing shortage and huge opposition to local development because no one has the time to go through planning in a kind of the considered way it should be managed. I personally am in favour of a kind of national corporation handing out the funding, but I think they should hand that development funding out to specific local areas and then local areas should have the right to decide the design, the location and so on, but they should have to meet their numbers. They should have to.
And the difficulty you get there is the partisanship thing. Yeah. And actually one of the things that was quite interesting and actually uncharacteristic for British politics, if you think about the establishment of the Manchester metropolitan mayoral area, there was a sort of, when Richard Leese dealing with his Labour, basically dealing with George Osborne and the Treasury, there was an element of bipartisanship to just get that stuff up and running.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is quite uncharacteristic. And one of the things that tends to happen, when you have a long incumbency, a sort of a midterm effect punishing local government, punishing the national party means you get, for example, a lot of Labour councils under a national Tory government, and then the Tories will want to try and use their central levers to undermine Labour locally and boost the Tories locally. The reality is how much of that is going to be done on the basis of who you can work with for partisan reasons and how much of it would ideally be done in terms of what's best for the country, what's best for the region. Is a Labour government going to do massive favours to Tory areas and vice versa? Well, everything we've seen about British politics in the last 10, 20 years tells us that's quite hard. Almost everything tells us that's quite hard.
It's quite possible that the results in the locals won't reflect Labour's pretty huge lead in the national polls. And at that point, obviously, you know, the Conservatives will start celebrating. But does it actually tell us anything meaningful about what Labour needs to do, about the direction it's going in? Or is it just a function of the way the locals work?
It always tells you something, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, because you can always extrapolate some kind of national swing, and whether that's how plausibly that is reflecting what national opinion polls are telling you, but also turnout is different, and you know, different areas elect on different cycles, and so the fact that, you know, this is the last time a lot of these areas were lost elected councillors was the more or less the peak of Boris Johnson's popularity, the vaccine bounce, as it was called at the time, shortly before his catastrophic fall from grace and the inevitable, not all, the inexorable Tory slide towards where they are now. I mean, the short answer is, you know, you have to always be really wary of, you know, projecting a very Westminster-centric horse race political gossipy story about the future of Rishi Sunak. Is Keir Starmer getting it right onto an incredibly complex picture? But there will be sufficient data in there to tell you whether or not Keir Starmer is as on course for Downing Street as we think he is.
Hannah, is Labour, assuming they win the general election?
let's just assume that.
Yeah. Is it going to be able to tackle the big problem that lots of councils face, the really existential problem, rising demand for the statutory services that they have to deliver, like special educational needs provision, things like that, that leave them hardly any money for anything else? Are they going to be able to tackle that properly?
There is only one way to tackle that, and that is to fund them more effectively. You know, the situation that we're in now hasn't, you know, just been a result of kind of global financial issues. It is a direct result of the austerity agenda under George Osborne at the beginning of this 14-year Conservative term, took the decision to basically remove funding for core services. And, you know, remember the big society? Apparently we're all going to pick up doing these essential things that that actually our society can't function without, things like social care, special educational need provision. It just goes on and on. So yeah, you've got to fund it, and in the short term, that's incredibly painful on the Treasury, and that's a big argument that has to be had at the centre. But there is no other way to resolve, as you describe it, as an existential crisis, because you can't continue to have services controlled at a local level and then starve the people who run them of the money they need to do that. I mean, look at Birmingham. That's exactly what's happened because of, you know, it's partly to do with a pay deal, of course. But, you know, what you end up with is a huge crisis where you're just facing bankruptcy.
Why don't we trust local government in this country? I mean, it's not just Whitehall, is it? Is it too late for us to be more like Germany, with regions that have real clout, that make real decisions about themselves? Could we be, you know, a bit more like that? Or it just the history of Britain just make that impossible?
We don't trust it because central government keeps using it as a pawn. So it's unable to actually behave in a way that demonstrates its abilities, really. And so you end up with the tough stuff being passed down to them so that they can blame local authorities for the decisions that they're actually making at the centre. And also, I would say, because we don't pay our councillors enough, so you don't get always the quality of candidate that you need for the seriousness of the work that goes on. So, yes, we don't trust local government because of the decisions that are made at the centre.
I'm a little bit more optimistic than that. I think, actually, we've turned a corner. Change happens in this country incredibly slowly and incrementally, and consensus, yeah, it is always stealthy. So you started this whole segment saying, well, basically everyone now agrees that localism is a good thing. Well, they do, but it's happened just over time. It's just a drip process now. So it's a consensus that snuck up on British politics. And in the meantime, yeah, the London mayoralty is well established. That's a serious role. Andy Burnham, the Manchester one, serious role. Andy Street now increasingly to an extent, whoever gets that job. And people are starting to recognise the importance of those positions, and they can make a difference. And actually, I think some of the mistrust that we have is really a legacy of the 1980s, and a perception from central government under Thatcher, with the supportive media, that local government was, especially in London, was run by mad loony lefties, which some of it was, but also that was a way of basically saying that they're fanatics and fools and you can't trust them. and they'll just blow all the money. And then in the new Labour reinvention of the Labour Party, kind of adopting exactly that view as well. So then reinforcing it as a bipartisan consensus that local government was full of mad lefties.
But also the failure of their attempt at creating regional assemblies as well, that there was this kind of big push under New Labour for some form of localism, a kind of broader localism, regionalism, if you like, that never came off. So I think that embedded that nervousness.
And so it's been a long, slow, grinding process. But then in the meantime, I think actually what's happened is councillors, local government have just become often the more pragmatic, rational, sensible people in politics, and much better at bipartisanship. I mean, the reason Andy Street is much more moderate and, for want of a better word, centrist and sensible than Rishi Sunak is he's got voters to appeal to who would otherwise be voting Labour. You know, so you are developing, you have cultivated some serious people, actually, and whereas Westminster MPs increasingly unserious, and actually the conventional view has slightly flipped on its head. You've got grown-ups in local government and children on the green benches in the House of Commons.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
We've reached the end of the show, so what are the stories that have gone under the radar this week? Raph, what's been happening?
Well, it wouldn't be Oh God, What Now? Formerly the Romaniacs if I didn't raise the Brexit controls finally being introduced. I mean, I think we've talked about this before. It's import controls. Yeah, the European Union was ready to put controls on imports to the EU, exports from the UK right from the get-go. But the UK did not want to impose the necessary equivalent customs controls because the infrastructure wasn't there. It would impose additional cost. It would drive up inflation, more bureaucracy. Basically, all the things that make Brexit a bad idea and make leaving the single market a stupid, friction-inducing, sand in the gears of the economy, why on earth did we do it? No, I'm not over it thing. Yeah, they've finally done. They haven't even now. I mean, they postponed it. It's been 3 years, 5 or 6 deferrals. They're not even doing it fully now. There have been reports already that they're just waving stuff through, not really checking. They haven't even activated the checking systems properly. You know, guess what? Brexit, bad idea. And yet, because British politics being what it is, somehow no one wanted to have an argument about that when it happened on Tuesday.
I think the most extraordinary thing for me about that is that they've got no plan for what to do with lorries that fail these checks. So those lorries should just drive off.
And they don't know where they're going.
It's like, you know, I remember you used to talk about things that fell off the back of a lorry that were being sold. And it just strikes me as a particular danger now that might happen. Hannah, faith schools.
Yes, so talking and also special educational needs, which we're mentioning too. So faith schools, the government has this plan to lift the cap of 50% of pupils with a faith in new faith schools, which the current cap has been, you know, half of pupils can come from the faith, but the other half have to come from the rest of the community to make sure it's actually serving the community. Well, that cap's going to be lifted. And even more weirdly than that, and I think even more troublingly than that, they're also overturning the rule that meant that schools for children with special educational needs and disabilities couldn't have any faith requirements, that they were there to serve the needs of those children primarily and couldn't have a secondary kind of ethos. It was fundamentally about providing enough proper education for those kids that needed it. Well, that now they're allowing a faith provision in those schools too. I presume they're doing that to try and meet their targets for extra special schools because they've been very clear that they admit that there has been under provision and that it's causing a crisis, and they put their hands up about that, and they promised to fund a large number of new schools. And maybe they believe they can only actually achieve that by engaging the faith school community. But I am really worried about the implications for that. It's been hard enough for families who are coping with kids with special needs to have their needs assessed and correctly supported. And now the idea that to access these new places, they're going to have to go through some extra leap of kind of showing up at, you know, a C of E church every Sunday for 15 weeks or something to fit some criteria. I just find it really depressing.
Yeah, the government was claiming today, or the education secretary was claiming that it was somehow stopping them from expanding this 50% cap, which makes no sense at all. Like, it's just a complete, oh, there's just no, you know, my year six boy is better at logic than this. My under the radar is that it's been 20 years since EU enlargement. Nobody in this country seems to have noticed. I've seen no coverage whatsoever of this, I suppose for the obvious reasons, but it's a massive thing. Millions of people in this country would not be here without EU enlargement, or very unlikely to be here. And I don't know, part of me says we should still celebrate it, despite everything.
It's one of the most successful public policies of all time. I mean, in terms of just, you know, locking, you know, former communist countries into, well, for the most part, liberal democratic systems. You know, sorry, Hungary. But, you know, just the economic outcomes in the accession countries speak for themselves. I mean, it's amazing. And the bitter irony that the UK was a very active driver of maximalist expansion. You know, the France in particular, very sceptical. And the UK view was, no, we should go wide.
Yeah, we actually let in people more, you know, more willingly and more easily than other EU countries did. Well, if you're listening and you're from the EU accession countries, we remember you. And that's the show. Thanks to Raf.
Oh, thank you.
Hannah.
Thank you.
And Nikki. The first episode of American Friction, hosted by Jacob Jarvis and Chris Jones, featuring Nikki, is out on Friday, May the 3rd. So if you find the US election bizarre and confusing, go and have a listen. It's out every Friday, right up until November. Stick around for the extra bit after Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a massive salute to our army of generous supporters, which is growing day by day. You could join the ranks too and get the podcast early and without ads, plus lots more. Search Oh God, What Now? Patreon to find out how. We'll see you next time.
Hello, and thanks enormously for your contribution to the Fighting Fund to Benjamin Dyer, Sheila Needham, AD and Kay Fountain.
And greetings from me, and thanks for your generosity to Jane, John Margots, Chris and David Harper.
Thanks and welcome aboard to brand new supporter Alex. And also to some past Patreon backers who've come back on board. Welcome home to Tom Hunt, Holly Wright and David Martin. Hamza Yousaf resigned as Scottish First Minister this week. He said he was sorry for the hurt he'd caused the Greens in dumping them from the coalition, but at the same time, he insisted it was the right thing to do. There's usually a moment in a politician's life when they overreach themselves and suddenly they're toast. But who else springs to mind?
Well, I mean, overreaching southern toasting, Liz Truss. I mean, yeah. He really went for it pretty hard. And just, you know, every aspect of that was, I mean, maybe that's too obvious a case, but I'm just...
There was Thatcher, depressed. Wasn't there, with the poll tax?
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Does a long incumbency lead you to... That's slightly, I suppose, an interesting phenomenon where you at the point at which you start to feel you can do anything... Is often an indication of your vulnerability. I mean, David Cameron actually thinking, well, I've got a brilliant idea to solve the problem of the Conservative Party. We'll have a referendum on leaving the European Union. I mean, that was a pretty serious overreach.
Can I go for one that's outside policy? The John Prescott egg moment. I feel like the thump moment after the egg. I feel like he leaned in so hard.
That was a teaser for the bonus bit of this week's podcast. If you'd like a little bit more Oh God, What Now? Every week, without ads and a day early, then sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £3 a month. Next week, because of the bank holiday, we'll be recording on Tuesday. Thanks for listening and see you next week.